November 28, 2022 work session with the interior legislators. We'll be discussing the city legislative capital priorities. The interior delegation. So, y'all want to pick out our priorities list? Mr. Clayworth, you have the first priority. Maintaining PERS cap contribution rate at 22%. You'd like to take the lead in that, sir?
Sure. At first, I'd like to thank all of you for coming. I know that you have about a million of these things in the next 30 days or whatever, and we're all expecting you to be at every one of them, you know, and that's tough. But thank you for coming out on a cold night and being with us. We know that our wish lists are going to be at the bottom of what's happening in Juneau. The good old days when we could put out big wish lists and get them fulfilled are not here much anymore, and we understand that. But there's certain things that we, you know, that can be of great help to us that don't have a big price tag. And one of them is number one, maintain PERS contribution rate. Reduce the municipality's PERS contribution rate from 22%. We're trying to be more proactive. As you know, when we went from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan, there was a lot of angst down in Juneau. And at the end of all that, and with the studies that our former CFO at the borough had done, incredible studies looking into the whole situation, they came up with a flat formula for all of Alaska. Prior to that, we had all had different rates, and ours at the city would swing drastically. Some years we'd be paying almost 30 cents in the dollar, and the next year it might be 19 cents in the dollar, and we could never figure out how Juneau's mathematics was working on that. And so for many years, we actually worked to get most of our employees into their union plans and actually get out of the PERS system, which didn't make some people in Juneau very happy with us. But we still have, our fire and our policemen are a part of the system. So in that all kind of hit the fan down there, and they came up with a formula where all the municipalities will be at 22 cents on the dollar. And as most of you know, of that 22 cents, that tier four employee is getting the benefit of roughly 10 cents or less, last I checked. The majority of that is going to the legacy debt that is still on the books in Juneau. When I was mayor, it got up to about $12 billion of debt. Governor Parnell threw a whole bunch of money at it at the time. It was somewhere, it was around $6 million, something like $3
million?
$3 billion, yes. So it was reduced. That was the first real downward slope that we saw. The PERS portion of it, as we stated in here in the background information, is down to about $3 billion or something. Let's see. Do I have the right one here again? Oh, it's in the resolution. It's in the resolution we have later on the agenda. I'm sorry. I'm going to do this by memory. $3 billion. This last year, the actuary, I guess, is reporting that the investments did not go well. And so there's a close to another $2 billion or so that might be adding to that debt. Is that close, Yuri?
It's on.
There you go.
Test. Okay. Yeah, $3.2 billion was the unfunded liability at June 30, 2021. And as of October 31, 2022, so last month, there's an unaudited $2.9 billion loss in the system. So roughly doubled since June 30, 2021.
So our concern is that this 22 cents is going to continue on into perpetuity. The union plans that we're in are far less than that. We could offer Social Security and a 401k and give the employee a great benefit that's far less than 22 cents on the dollar. But this is wishful thinking on our part. I get it. we would like to see, rather than just trying to maintain it all the time, maybe an effort to try and reduce that. The cities didn't incur that debt. You know, it was totally the function of the actuary and the ARM board and Juneau's really lack of oversight in those years to allow it to get that far out of control. And we were always told up until that year that we had a surplus. And then all of a sudden they said, no, city, your share is $80 million of debt. And on the books each year, we show our debt. It's not $80 million anymore, thank God. But it was out of our hands. We, you know, you kind of trust the state to do this. But now we're having to pick up this bill, the city taxpayers, for year after year after year to pay off that legacy debt. So at the very least, hold it at 22%, but hopefully work it down. I think that's enough.
Thank you. Mr. Prox, Representative Prox.
Yeah, thank you. You mentioned the borough's chief financial officer did some sort of a study related to this issue.
Mr. Lamb.
Michael Lamb. Okay. There's actually two or three parts to it. Incredible work that he did on that. Yeah. Yep. It was showing basically that Juneau didn't have a clue what they were doing. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. That is available where?
I'm sure the borough would still have copies of it. Somewhere in my archives, I'm sure I've got a copy of it, too.
Okay.
Mr. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. I just like to, Mr. Pleaworth and I have, we talk about this from time to time.
We did.
Just go back. I just want to look the last sentence on this first paragraph. Unfortunately, because of incredible lack of oversight and mismanagement, massive debts were incurred. Right, that's how we got there. So, just FYI, you know, I take the lessons learned, and don't make them again. And you know, this last session, you know, here we go again. You know, revenue comes into the finance table and says we don't need to fund the health care, right? For TERS, because we got too much money. And I told the gentleman from revenue, don't ever come in here and say that we got too much money. I said, did you run a Monte Carlo scenario on why we don't need to pay because we've got too much money? He said, no. I said, then you're one catastrophic event away from failure. To Yuri's point, now we're down $2.9 billion. And you're going to be looking at a supplemental coming back to the legislature. Pay the bill.
Ms. Sprinkle.
Because I don't know enough, I will ask. Is the city legally obligated to have to pay this, since it's the state debt?
Municipalities contribute 22% to state law.
So that could be changed.
Could be changed.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions on that one? Okay. If we go to our resolution 5036 as amended, number 2 and 3 are from me, and they're both similar. 2 is provide relief from DEC, PFOS, and plume characterization requirements. Some history. In 2016, we found out that our firefighting training center containment device area for firefighting training, we have a containment center engineered fine, but it had been unused for 20 years, so the DE. So we went to decertify it, which means we had to do a deep background phase 3 environmental on this, or phase 2 anyway. And they found that the containment system never failed. What they found was that the firefighter crews that came from state of Alaska, Fairbanks North Star Borough, Chena Goldstream, Esther, North Star, City of Fairbanks, Fort Wayne, or whoever used it, in their exuberance over the term that it was used, would put foam outside the containment area. The foam had PFOS in it, which was certified by the EPA, a 3M product. Well, with that, it seeped down into the water table and then started contaminating. So we had a contamination area from the off 30th Avenue and Wilbur from that location across the Pegger Lakes all the way down to Jillian Square and into Taku Subdivision. It spread that much over a 20-25 year cycle. City of Fairbanks, we immediately cleaned it up at the same time. State of Alaska, City of North Pole, Flint Hills, Department of Defense, we're all fighting over PFAS out at different locations. We jumped out. We spent $5.3 million, and we brought new water to 75 households at a cost of about $76,000 a piece. We just did it. Got a wonderful letter from the DEC thanking us for this jumping on it. What we're finding out now is we put in over 200 test wells for mitigation. Where is this at? Defining the plume. And what we're finding now, the DEC is wanting the City of Fairbanks to do more tests, but there's no consequence for the reason why they want to test. There's nothing that's come through the EPA. There's nothing that says we're looking at this now, but they want us to spend more money on tests when we have shut this portion of it down. And what we've also said is if it comes to within 70%, an area comes within 70% of the mitigation level of the EPA, we will go in and put in new water systems. It's never reached that. But I have a fear that the EPA, and I've talked with Senator Sullivan's staff on this, he's going to work on it. I would like you to address it with the DEC. Not to have us do any testing that's unneeded, to try and work with the EPA to stop any redefinition of the parts per billion on the requirements. Because if they do that, this is that one financial item that would be come back and be that would have to pay if they wanted, that would bankrupt the City of Fairbanks. It's that one item that we do not have the financial resources to ever go back and clean up. We are in a lawsuit with against 3M, I believe. We're going back to sue them. We have not gone after any of the borough entities on the firefighters, firefighting programs, Esther, Gina Goldstream, North Star. We have not gone after any of the users out there. We don't want to. So I'm looking at you. Talk with the DEC. Work with them. Be the firewall, if you can, on items 2 and 3, because it's that one item that can bankrupt a municipality real fast. Any questions? Those are my two. Well, Mr. Cleworth.
Just add something to that. The mayor is right. The city covered all the costs of this. And the way we did it financially is it's outside the task cap. As you know, you folks that come out of the borough, claims and judgments are outside of the cap. And so we tax people for it, both commercial and residential properties, and they've paid the bill for really everybody in the borough. And that was frustrating because, you know, there's a feeling that we maybe should split that cost with the state and the borough and everybody that use that facility. We're looking, I think the mayor is looking for, let's just don't make it worse.
Yeah.
And
It's not a financial investment from you, but, boy, is it a good addressing with them, if you could. Representative Prox.
Do I understand you correctly that the DEC is asking for testing requirements above and beyond what the EPA is asking for?
I would like to have our building engineer, excuse me, Bob, are you available to come up and address that a little bit on what has happened in the past and what your worries are? Bob Pristash, he's a city engineer.
Good evening, everyone. In the past, we've just tested for P4 and PFOS, but there's certain breakdown chemicals or chemicals that are associated with PFOS that DEC is asking us to test now, an additional 18 chemicals. It's still an advisory or health advisory level. The original PFOS contamination health advisory level was 70 parts per trillion, an ordinance dropped it down to 70%, 59 parts per trillion. And if a well had 59 or higher, we switched them off from their well to municipal water. Now I understand health advisory level is much lower.
Okay. And PFAS is not a listed hazardous chemical at this point, is that correct?
That's my understanding. It's a health advisory level. EPA put out a health advisory level of 70 parts per trillion for drinking water. There's different levels for discharge to ground, soil to ground surface.
Mm-hmm. They still use it in their fire retardant.
Right.
And DEC is following the EPA's guidance.
Keywords, guidance and advisory. Okay.
Senator Bishop.
Just a quick follow-up. And you're having to do this testing monthly?
No, it's not monthly. I think it's yearly.
Okay. And they're charging you for the test? Do you do the test? Do you contract with a third party? Or is DEC?
Contract with an environmental firm. And they use existing wells, or they put in new wells.
Okay.
Any other questions for Mr. Tomaszewski?
Yeah, and you say they're still using this foam?
Yes.
And where? Where are they using it now?
City of Fairbanks Fire Department.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. Yeah. It's still.
So when it gets sprayed on somebody's house, it just leaches down into the wells.
Yes.
How does that make sense?
Ours is not the reason why. Ours is to pay the bill. Chief of Staff here wants to say something.
One thing about PFAS and PFOA and the Life Health Advisory is that it's not just used in that foam. It's in everybody in this room has it on their clothes. You have it on your cooking utensils. They're finding it in our sewage. Everybody, that Life Health Advisory that Bob just spoke about, that lowers the level below what is detectable and below what every human on the planet already has in their body. So that's why we're asking for a little bit of like, hey, whoa, stop. This is absurd. Yeah, PFAS is in everything.
We have Fire Chief Rager on the line. He'd like to say a few words to you in regards to this matter. Chief?
Hello, all. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so... we actually don't use PFAS foam anymore. We stopped using it. We still use Class B foam, but it doesn't have the PFAS in it. And, you know, Mr. Sanders is correct. It's in our turnouts. It's used to make Teflon. It is in almost all plastic products in the world almost nowadays. But, just so we're clear that we've stopped using PFAS foam. It actually can't even be sold anymore. But that being said, the next foam or the next thing will be carcinogen in the long run. So, PFAS is everywhere.
Yep. Thank you, sir. Mr. Prox.
Well, just a comment. This is much bigger than the city of Fairbanks, and we probably would like some help on that.
Yeah, I've also been engaging Senator Sullivan, and I'll be engaging Senator Murkowski.
Yep.
I'd like to engage you. This is an all hands on deck.
Yep, I agree.
Thank you. Okay, moving on to, I'm sorry, Ms. Rogers.
I just wanted to say also, when you're saying this is a much bigger project, yes, it was. And I want to emphasize anytime we have a meeting on this that we are the only group that stepped up to work on a solution. And others who have used the facility, we discovered from many different sources that they couldn't find the records or they weren't sure or this or that or whatnot. We have never had anyone stand shoulder to shoulder with us to try and work with this problem. And I think all of us, when I'm looking around the room here, have all lived in various different circumstances and places besides just the city of Fairbanks proper. And so I know in talking with all of you in previous times, I've made it really clear that I'm way beyond my boundaries here is how I think of working on behalf of the city, and that is to work on behalf of the entire state because we are all part of a certain body of work and responsibility, and that we can't just hand things off to a certain arena. So I just want to say that at this particular juncture, and I'll be saying it again probably at another time. Thank you.
Ms. Sprinkle, do you have something? Anyone else on this? These two items? Okay. Going on to item four, maintain a baseline of $60 million annually in community assistance program funding, formerly known as revenue sharing. Whose item, whose number was that? Yuri, could you address that one for us then? All of us. Okay. Yuri, could you address that one for us?
I can give you a little brief on that. I think our incumbents will know about community assistance. Formerly revenue sharing, the statute of debt was actually changed about 5 years ago, 2017. The $60 million was that funding level was originally tied to oil and gas taxes, the progressivity factor in oil and gas taxes. And then that changed in 2013. And a few years later, the community assistance program was changed again at $30 million level, and the legislature has generally funded that level most of the past decade. There have been some years where they added a nominal amount to the formula, and those funds were prorated around all the community, prorated to all the communities. But the level hasn't been at the $60 million level since about 2012 or so.
Okay. Any questions on this one? Ms. Sprinkle.
Mine's a comment. I think June's mentioned this before, that I find it a little irksome that it's called community assistance instead of revenue sharing, since it's coming from state money. So I'm just going to throw that out. I hope we can rephrase
Ms. Rogers.
That.
Okay, I'll follow up with that. Usually I'm the only one in the room who says that. I've been saying this for years and years and years. I think that changing the tone of how we label things makes for some real different sense of responsibility for things. And the idea that we are a state of people who all need to work together in order to achieve success on behalf of the entire state means that we shouldn't mislabel things to the point of that we're not capable, or that, you know, that we need assistance, but that this is something that was revenue sharing. Sharing is a very, very specific word that most everybody understands, especially if you have a family. All of the kids are given a certain sense of entitlement to whatever is in that family, and we are part of a family of the state. And if I break it down to those terms, many times I get a lot more listeners on it. But the idea of changing that to community assistance, I think, was beyond being responsible. It was accept the responsibility for each and every person in the state by using that term. So, thank you. There we go.
Mr. Cleworth.
I'll follow up on that a little bit, too. Over the years, the city has taken over many of the state roads. Illinois Street, Aurora Drive, Trainer Gate Road, all those used to be state highways, and we've taken them over. We maintain them. It's our nickel. And I remember the discussion back then was, well, you get revenue sharing. We share oil wealth with you, and you can use that to help defer your costs. So, in some years, I remember 2001 or two or something, we were not given any revenue sharing. It just disappeared for a year, and then it came back again. So one is the stability of it. When we do budgeting, it's really nice to know approximately what we're going to get. That would help us tremendously. And two, there is this implied promise in the past that the city would be reimbursed for the obligations we took over from the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you started going there 5 years ago. We put the community assistance, revenue sharing, whatever you want to call it, we wrapped it at the Senate Finance table into the PERS, into PCE. So we could have a quasi-reasonable guaranteed return, but this year, I don't know what it's going to look like on PCE.
Yeah, that power cost equalization fund that goes to fund energy costs in the rural parts of the state. It's about $1 billion fund, and the first call on that money is for the PCE program, and the second call is for community assistance.
Right.
There's a waterfall effect. There's two programs that fall after community assistance. So when that fund is healthy, community assistance is funded fully. So, yeah, we'll have to see how that what the level of that fund is here in the next couple months.
Mr. Ringstead.
I've seen this thing called all kinds of different things over the last 40 years. I don't care what you call it, just send me the money.
Any other discussion items on item number 4? Seeing none, I'd like to call up Chief Dupuy on items number 5 and 6. They came directly from him. Item number 5 is allow Tier 1, 2, and 3 PERS retirees to return to work under Tier 4 to fill critical shortages and continue to collect retirement. Chief Dupuy, could you expand upon that, please?
I can. So basically in the simplest form is we have a lot of retired police officers, firefighters, teachers, you name it, that are in Tiers 1, 2, and 3, and they're not able to come back and take a state or a PERS employment position within city, state, UAF, any of those entities. So the thought behind it was if you allowed Tiers 1, 2, and 3 to retire, collect their retirement under that system, come back into the PERS system in Tier 4, so where they're just putting money away into the 401k, but still paying into that, you know, the PERS pot of money, we would tap a group of employees that we know are probably good employees that retired from the state or the city with 20 or 30 years of service, and they'd be willing to come back and provide those services again, but not have to give up the retirement that they've already received, if that makes sense.
Now, Senator Bishop, you started out life as Commissioner of Labor. Does this make sense to you?
Well, with the post-COVID world, and I think everyone is reevaluating how they look at workforce and how they're going to meet these workforce challenges and shortages going forward. So, I mean, everything's on the table. I know I was already thinking about talking to Kate Sheehan about this at big admin in Juneau when we go back having that conversation.
It's a non-revenue item from your budgets per se, but it helps out the municipalities. It really will. So anything you can do, I'd really appreciate that. We would really appreciate that.
Just to piggyback on that, I think it helps out everybody, not just municipalities, but you look at the University of Alaska and how many job openings they have right now. You know, say you have a officer that retires after 25 years and they want to go work, I don't know, housing maintenance up at the university. They can't take that full-time job because they're in a PERS position, so they can't go back into a PERS position. The state's eliminating all of these workers that would potentially take those jobs because of that caveat with the previous tiers.
Ms. Sprinkle.
Wouldn't it also save us money in training costs because they'd be trained up?
It could, yes.
That's a big boon for us. It's expensive to bring those people on. Thank you.
Any other representative Prox, and then we'll go to Mr. Cleworth.
The previous outfit that I worked for hired security guards in particular that were retired from public service of some sort. Do you have any statistics to illustrate sort of how many people are willing to come back to work for somebody?
I don't. I can tell you that we opened up a temporary part-time position for a former sergeant. He came back and is working as a detective right now with the Fairbanks Police Department. We've had several other that are interested in doing something like that, but their biggest question is, how does it affect my PERS retirement?
Absolutely.
They don't want to mess with that. Right. So,
I suspect that this is a very good idea. It would be nice to have some sort of statistics to back that up.
Representative-elect Will Stapp.
Thank you. I think this is certainly probably has a lot of merit. I do have some concerns. So basically, in practical terms, so the employee would still collect their Tier 1 defined benefit, and then they would be collecting that while being employed as a new police officer, correct?
Correct.
So I think that helps solve short-term retention and employment problems. I'm kind of concerned about the long-term effect on, say, new hires. I mean, you could have a potential where you have a ton of folks who are getting a really nice pension employed already come back to work, and then you might end up driving down wages for new employees that long-term. So I would be really curious to see what the data would say on that, if that makes sense.
We can look into that for you. Representative LeCarrick.
Thanks. I'm just wondering, so right now, say an educator retires and they want to come back 3 years later and work for a couple of years, does that somehow make them ineligible for their Tier 1, 2, or 3 retirement? In other words, what does this change from what might currently happen if a retired employee comes back to work?
I'm not the expert on it, but my understanding is if the employee is retired and they want to come back to work, they're required to pay back a certain portion of that retirement that they've already collected. And then they no longer collect the retirement as they're continuing their employment.
Okay.
Our city attorney here?
The last that I heard the question of it, all that happens is that you'd have to stop drawing your current benefit. And you'd go back into the system. And as the rules go, you'd go back in the system as a Tier 1 or 2 or 3 employee, not as a Tier 4 employee. So it would take a change to say that those people would come back and could go back as Tier 4. So take a change in that in the system.
Mr. Cleworth.
A follow-up on that, Paul. For a while there, we used to bring people back under a contract. And a former policeman would come in, and we would hire them, you know, as a contract labor. We wouldn't pay them any benefits because they were already accruing them with their retirement. And then somebody made us stop doing that. Do you remember why?
I remember that, but I don't remember the hows and the whys, yes.
Yeah, they said that was illegal or something, and they put an end to that.
Mr. Ringstead.
Pretty ingenious idea.
One of the other issues, I think, to your question, there was concern, as I recall, about employees trying to double dip and say, well, I'm going to draw retirement and a paycheck at the same time. And that was probably an area of focus of what you're talking about. But there was concern in Juneau over that.
Well, and if I can follow up, and this kind of goes to Will Stapp's comment as well, is in the short term, there's so many vacant positions that I don't see any issue with rehiring retired employees. But in the long term, you could end up with that double dipping happening. So it's definitely just something to look into. Yeah.
Any other items on number 5 before we move on? Okay. Seeing none, item number 6, increase SART funding for Fairbanks to $150,000 to meet current liabilities. Chief Dupe, you want to bring us up to speed on that one, since that was one of your items?
Sure. You know, the state mandates that we pay for the SART examinations at the hospital anytime that somebody goes over and has one of those kits done. I think it's increased from $1,500 to $1,700 a piece this year, and actually, that is 2 visits, so each one is actually $3,200 a piece. And we're on par to go about $125,000 this year for the SART kits that we're responsible for. So,
okay. Seeing no questions, we'll go to the capital priorities. Item number one is a Public Works backup generator that's estimated to cost $1 million. And what we did was we redefined our priorities from our original one. We looked and said, okay, what is going to immediately benefit the city of Fairbanks? And we need a new generator building out there, a new generator shed. It's over the last 30 years, we've put a lot of more electrical and operating components in there. So our generator system is inadequate, and we thought if we're going to ask for something, let's keep the lights on at Public Works if you could help us. Any thoughts on that? Senator Bishop.
And Yuri, you'll bring the backup on this?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Any other questions on that? Item number two, no, I'm sorry. Oh, Mr. Prox, Representative Prox.
How long, you know, there's intermittent power outages. How often is this a significant problem for the Public Works?
It hit them hard last year. It hit them hard last winter a few times when we lost a few power outages. So it's nothing that I'm going to say that it's a critical item, but it is a needed item over, I'd say, the next 3 to 5 years that we must address. So for the continuity of our work and the safety.
And you've talked to Golden Valley about this?
Not that I know of. This is from our Public Works Director.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah. Ms. Rogers.
I just wanted to add that given this particular item of discussion here, one of the circumstances of responsibility of the City Council is public safety. And this is really at the heartbeat of public safety. So it's all really a mixture there.
Representative Prox.
That might clarify that. Does the emergency dispatch or something work out of the same building?
No, they do not. And we had that issue earlier with emergency dispatch, and we fixed that.
Okay, so it's the utility. I guess I'm not seeing how this is urgent.
Mr. Ringstead.
Most of our power outages seem to come whenever you're having bad weather.
Yeah.
Public Works, these the guys got to go out and take care of the snow and the safety of the roads and take care of a lot of our when you need this. Okay. It's like it never happens on a summer day, you know.
Right.
So
we're going to change when snow can fall too. If by statute now it has to fall on the weekend. I don't understand why, but.
Mr. Cleworth.
One thing more, Mike, is the borough stores a lot of their equipment out there, too. I don't think people realize that in one of the large buildings we have there. And so it's more than just the city's equipment. It's a lot of the borough's equipment out there, too. And so we lose power, and those buildings get cold, we're going to have a problem.
Any other discussion on item number one? Seeing none, we're going to go to item number two of capital priorities. This is the big one. Redesign construction roads, sidewalks, and drainage in the Island Home subdivision with a request of $9.6 million. I wouldn't call that a shovel-ready project, but we put in a application grant to the federal government last year, and we did not get it, so we had all the information, all the backup data, good costs on that ready to go. So that came from our engineering department saying, David, if you can get one thing, we have to come in and do Island Home sometime. If we could request this, that'd be great. So it's our request. Mr. Stapp, that's your district, sir.
I was going to speak to this. So I would love to see the engineering, I say, reports and design specs if you have them. Ironically, this issue didn't come up at all for me in Island Homes. It came up a lot in Hamilton Acres regarding redesign and drainage and people's properties being flooded by the breakup and snow. But it didn't actually come up at all in the Island Homes neighborhood. So I'd be curious to hear more about it. So
We'll get that to you. Any other questions in regards to item number two? Seeing none, our final item is construction of law enforcement training center in Interior Alaska with a request of $6 million. That is, I would believe, a joint item for Borough, City of North Pole, City of Fairbanks. And since it was a joint item, it's our number three item that we have on there. Any questions on that? Our thought was, I believe the thought is, all entities contribute to this. City of North Pole or the borough with the property, City of Fairbanks we can put in the drive, things like that. We have the equipment. I believe the state of Alaska would operate it, and this was also a request from Chief Dupuy from City Police in regards to the construction operation in need of this. Chief, do you want to address anything on this? Nope.
We need it.
Okay. Ms. Rogers.
I remember a year or so ago in Juneau, we had some conversations with you, Mr. Prox, and you had some definite ideas about this. Yes.
Yeah, this was brought up to me 2 years ago, I guess, by the chief police of the city of North Pole. And I'm trying to encourage making it a joint public use facility plus a training facility. I think we'd get more out of it, and I think there would be a lot of public relations value in that. So I think it has moved on a little bit more from 2 years ago. I'm interested but happy to discuss ways that we can make this best utilization, I guess, for the facility.
This is a multi-governmental aspect.
Yep.
So it's all appreciated.
Yep.
Any other? Yes, Ms. Representative Carrick.
Can you explain what kind of training is provided there? Because it's my understanding, which I'm happy to be corrected to, that most officers in both the city, borough, and state receive their training, at least initial training, down in the
Sitka
Training Academy. So what is the training that is provided with this facility?
We'll go with Chief Dupuy first, and Chief of Staff Mike Sanders wanted to jump in there too. So
you are correct. Initially, we receive our training either at the Sitka Academy or, the City of Fairbanks. At the university, actually had a training academy for a while. They're trying to get that back up and running. But that's just the initial training. So by policy, we're required to qualify with our firearms 4 times a year. And that's no additional training. And as you know, if you don't continuously train on these things, you lose your ability to maintain your proficiency, especially with driving. Obviously, our officers are in the car all day long, driving almost their entire shift, and that's one of those things. It's a very high liability function, and we need to keep them trained, especially when they're going, responding to calls, lights and sirens, driving fast, and having to make those split-second decisions. And there really is no place in town currently for us to do the high-speed section of the driving. The EVOC course that we do, our policy says we're supposed to do it, I believe, once a year, and we haven't been able to maintain that standard just because it's so difficult for us to find a place to do that. I know North Pole was sending guys all the way to Fort Greeley to do their defensive driving on the cold weather track that they have out there.
Representative Stapp.
So given the fact, I've spoken with Representative Brox regarding this and his kind of his ideas to how to facilitate this. So my question is, we have, if we're talking one or maybe quarterly zero on qual, what I read from APOA was basically stand and shoot, sitting shoot, maneuver shoot, zero on qual, and, of course, this maneuver element with vehicles. And you know, we have, on the federal level, we have thousands of ranges in the YTA. We have Fort Greeley. I mean, it didn't seem to me like there would be a big of an issue to facilitate with our military partners once a year some time, some range time. You know, so I'm curious if folks have looked at partnering with the range control cadre on Fort Wainwright that could easily kind of facilitate this.
We have, and the problem is when you're an outside entity going in onto Fort Wainwright or Eielson and you want to use their facilities, you can sign up for it, but if they have something that trumps you, you get kicked out of the spot, and then you have to reapply for it and find the time. We can't afford to do that with staffing levels the way we are. We have to plan these things out. Like, we're right now planning it for our firearms training in February, and we have to, you know, we have to bring guys in on overtime, and with the military element, we also have to get all of our instructors to be range certified on their range. They have to have all these qualifications, and then we have to have so many instructors there at the same time. It was not effective for us to be able to provide any kind of training out on Fort Wainwright. We did look into it 2 years ago, and it wasn't something that we could do.
Any other questions on the subject? Seeing none, I'd like to thank all of our interior delegation. Thank you very much for being here this evening. Mr. Morgan.
Mr. Mayor, I did want to recognize, looks like we have a couple people online as well. I don't know if that's Senator Kawasaki and then Sue Stancliffe, staff to Representative Mike Kronk. So just want to recognize that they're here. And also in the audience, we have staff from Senator Kawasaki's office and also from Representative LeBron's office.
Thank you for that, Yuri. Anything else? Mr. Ringstead, did you have anything? Okay. Again, appreciate it. We'll see you more. I've got a feeling our legislative committee here will, through Mr. Morgan, will be talking with you early and often. Try and put up with this, and I appreciate your time and effort. Thank you. We're adjourned.